question or comment from previous week on, previously we've been talking about protection by way of refuge. No problem. We all go for refuge. The question is always who or what you go for refuge in or to. You never know until your life is in great danger or you encounter great difficulty. And suddenly, what you put your faith in or what you put your trust in becomes very apparent. Usually, I don't remember the Buddha's Dhamma and Sangha. I always tell them, oh, weekend is here. I'm very stressed. Usually these days it's something to do with the internet. With Wi-Fi, unlimited data. And then it's usually net serve or web surfing or whatever. Previously I was watching Japanese anime. But things like this is like when you absorb your attention into something, they give you a kind of mild sense of pleasure. Then it took my attention away from things that are distracting. You find yourself stop thinking about work or stop thinking about anything that bothers you. And of course it's a form of distraction. But from a very lay person, very ordinary person point of view, it's a relief. It's a relief from all the unhappiness or anguish that comes when the mind kind of repeatedly dwell on certain topics or things that are distracting, you cannot immediately solve or you cannot immediately get rid of. Yeah. So in a sense, it's very effective. It's very effective in helping you to manage difficult feelings, difficult emotions, by not thinking about it. Okay. So it's good old distraction technique. And do not underestimate the power of distraction. So I strongly encourage you when all else fail and you cannot remember Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, by all means distract yourself from the distracting thing. Yeah, because then it's a relief, yeah. So the question is, so we encounter different very distressing situations, like we lost a friend in a car accident, or we witness an accident like that, yeah. And of course we wonder, but one day this person is perfectly fine and happy and healthy, playing badminton, the next day it's gone. And gone is a very sudden and very thorough way, there's nothing, nothing in between. You never get to say goodbye. You never get to set things in order. And then you wonder, what happened? And quite often, especially in a Buddhist context, you say, has that something to do with karma? Because how else can we account for such misfortune? And then we say, whether it's because this person has killed somebody in the past? Or sometimes people say, oh, I must have owned so and so a lot of debt in my previous life, so now I'm just repaying my past debt. Yeah. So we quite often we rely on karma, which we are going to look at today, as to explain on this. An explanation actually is a way for us to manage this stress, isn't it? Because we feel that if we can explain it, then we can put this very distressing situation, maybe find a place or some meaning to it. So then we can maybe put it to rest. And then we don't have to be so disturbed by it. Because I think as human beings, we find more disturbing if we encounter events or experiences that we can't account for. And we cannot put it in anywhere. And also the very sudden nature of it means that we also experience a great sense of powerlessness. We're powerless, we are very helpless, we can't control it, we can't do anything about it. So that is also very distressing. Yeah. Later I might talk to them about this coming explanation. Coming explanation, I usually think, this is my personal opinion, coming explanation is the cheapest and most of the time it's pretty useless thing. I can generate infinite number of coming explanations for any event you have encountered. You know, it could be something that happened to you last life, it happened to you 3.5 lives ago, or 725 lives ago. You know. I mean, anyway, there's nothing you can verify it, isn't it? I can just say that, oh, maybe you kill a human being previous life, or you kill a mosquito, but you live it long enough, you didn't verify it. And so killing a mosquito is as serious as killing a human being, or you know, you accidentally have a roadkill, you know, that poor rabbit or whatever. Kangaroo was in Australia. The kangaroo was about to, you know, get enlightened, so you kill a holy kangaroo. So that's why your punishment in this life is severe. But putting aside, you know, this explanation of karma, I think it's important for us, also for our own sanity, that we can make sense what is happening, that we are able to put to rest this sense of great disturbance, you know, and that we can find some meaning in all the happenings around us. And that's something we do naturally. We do it in many different ways. Some people rely on science, some people rely on religion, and so on and so forth. But so as far as we're concerned, the actual explanation is not so important. But the fact that we can, for ourselves and for those around us, we can find somehow a kind of meaning, a way to put things in order in our mind and heart, and so that we can, then we can find the appropriate way to respond to it. You know? So for example, you may find like someone that you know passed away suddenly, or find yourself suddenly in a very difficult situation. Quite commonly for a lot of Buddhists, at least for Tibetan Buddhists, to tend to rely on, of course, if there's some practical you can do, then you can offer help. But quite often, beyond the practical things, what a lot of us end up doing is, we take prayer. We make dedication. So, what it means is we try to keep the person in mind as we do our meditation, we do our daily prayer. We want to keep those people that we care about in mind. We dedicate the positive energy of our practice to them so that they, you know, hopefully they will be able to find the strength to overcome their difficulties. Or if they pass on, you know, we don't know what will happen to them, but we send them our best wishes. We hope that they will have either a good rebirth, or maybe they might be born in a pure land. But just by doing that simple act of dedicating and saying prayers, you know, then we feel that at least we keep that person in mind, you know, we sustain that connection. And I think that is actually a very helpful thing to do. So I would recommend, you know, in the event that we find something, we encounter something difficult, or something bad happens to those around us, or even to ourselves. You know, of course, we do what is practical, but on top of that, we can do this practice of dedication. Dedication means that, you know, even when I cannot do something physical to help you, I want to keep you in mind. I don't want to cause dismiss you. I also don't want to say, well, I don't want to think about it because it makes me very distressed. So I want to dismiss you. Go away. It's like, if I cannot help you, then you must disappear. Because otherwise it's too distressing. So with dedication, you don't have to. You can say that, look, I can't help you practically, or especially if someone has passed on, but I bring whatever positive things I can gather, and I dedicate it to you. I send forth my best wishes to you. And personally, I find that very powerful, very helpful. And it allows you to keep that person in mind, you learn to dismiss them from your concern, and you feel that you are actually contributing something towards their well-being. Okay, so let's start. So today I continue the theme of protection. Previously I talked about protection in terms of refuge, have refuge, having something that we can take refuge in, that we go for refuge in, is a way of protection. Primary protection of our mind and heart. Something that we can entrust, and then we can rely on, especially at difficult times. And then they can provide us with that protection, primary or especially to protect our mind, protect our heart from difficult emotions, difficult states of mind. So that is what we have covered previously in the 3 sessions on refuge. So today I want to move on to another way of looking at protection, which is a very Buddhist topic of karma. Karma actually just means action, which is to do with our actions. And in Buddhism, actions are of 3 types. Bodily actions means our physical behavior. Verbal actions, which means our speech. And mental actions, which means our thoughts. The kind of thing that we dwell on, we think about, we plan, we fantasize. So there are of three different types, something called the 3 doors of action. You know, physical, verbal, and mental. And all 3 of them, can bring about certain results. And the main point related to karma that I'm covering over this and next session is a very simple conclusion, and I'm going to elaborate on it. The conclusion is very simple. I was telling somebody, one of these class, that I saw it on one of the advertisements for this movie, John Wick, the third part. I think it said something like, actions have consequence. Because I'm sure there is a bit of John Wick. He's probably an armature or killed. But that is the same idea here in this topic of karma. To realize and to really kind of work with this idea that our actions have consequences. Just one line, very simple. Our actions have consequences. Okay? Although it sounds very simple, but I think it's actually very profound, and we can dig out a lot of things just based on this one line. And this is what we're going to consider seriously. But I sometimes also like to add a disclaimer clause. Disclaimer. Just in case you say, hey, you didn't tell me, you just said actions have consequences. There is a disclaimer, very important disclaimer. But bad things can still happen to good people. And good things can still happen to bad people. Okay? You must remember that. Because usually when you hear karma say, oh, you do good things will come to you. You do bad things will come to you. But actually the reality is, sometimes you do good things, but bad things come to you. And then you see people do bad things, good things happen to them. So, this mind is creating it. So I think it's good to have this statement that, in spite of this whole idea of karma, about our actions and consequences, but in reality, if you observe, let's say I'm a good person, I try my best to do good, but do not be surprised that bad things can still happen. Misfortune, bad things can still happen to me. And alternatively, I could be a very bad person. I set up to, I do all the bad things. Just for the fun of it. I can still experience good things. Okay? This is not uncommon to observe in the world. I think this is part of our reality. So we also need to reconcile that. But it's important to not have a too simple an idea about karma. Otherwise you will be setting yourself up to be disappointed. So
being a knowledge is just that to the extent that you actually do not have a kind of self-cherishing, do you actually have a need to seek refuge? If you start refuge,
okay, so you're saying regarding my teacher, the stories I shared previously, does he have the need to seek refuge? Is that what you're saying? Is it because you're saying that I regard my teacher as someone who has wonderful qualities? So, such a special person, does he still need to have refuge? Okay, so you're saying, no, my teacher, when he encounters here the tumor growth in his lung, yeah. So under those situations, right, most people, when they're diagnosed with like a possible cancer, you know, we probably panic, we're anxious, we seek refuge. So you wonder whether did my teacher actually also need to seek refuge under that kind of circumstances, is it? Yeah. But is it not just an ordinary person, but even someone who have some spiritual realization, they also have refuge, isn't it? In fact, they will probably have very firm refuge. They, because of that firm refuge, it protects their mind. That's why their mind become undisturbed. The mind is undisturbed because of some causes and conditions, right? And part of that causes and condition it could be their deep sense of understanding and their practice and of course their refuge. So in fact I think their refuge is even more firm and more stable than an ordinary person. An ordinary person may say that, oh, we're going to pray at Kuan Yin Temple, pray. But 1 month later, no effect, never mind. I switch to the Hindu temple next door and pray. No, just an ordinary person, our refuge is easily shaken because it doesn't have a very firm conviction, doesn't have a firm basis. So we only rely on most superficial things, like whether my prayers will be answered or not. But for someone who has some realization, their refuge has a very firm foundation based on their own understanding and their own realization. And that refuge will come in handy when they encounter difficult situation, will protect their mind, will bring them peace. Yeah. So I think he had very firm refuge based on his understanding and his practice. I would say that it's only inner refuge, you know. He could also pray he can say prayers, he can ask the monastery to say prayers on his behalf. Why not, right? You know, after all, you have connection, right? He has connection with Sarah Day and the entire monastery, thousands of monks. No. In fact, actually, every time he visits India while he was alive, it happened to a lot of these old monks, old lamas. They usually empty their entire saving account because they donate to all the monks in the monastery or they donate to their kangsan, which is the particular regional house that they belong to. Because, you know, usually they need money to repair the roof or for expansion or for maintenance, yeah. So there's no reason why he only has to rely on inner refuge, because he can also rely on outer refuge. He has all these people around him, he has a community that he can rely on, you know. People will drive him back and forth for treatment and things like that, isn't it? Yeah. So I don't think you need to think of someone special, then they only have inner refuge, they cannot have outer refuge. But what I can say is that their refuge is more firm and more stable because of their own personal experience and understanding and their conviction. Okay? Does that answer your question? But after all, you know, if you don't have the refuge, what's the point of practicing? Right? The whole idea of study and practice is to stabilize the refuge, is to help you understand it better. And this also when you are in need. You expect it to come up to support you, isn't it?
I'm not sure if it's that special, but I was just curious about what going on in his mind. Especially in the last moment, he was asked if I could get it to the meditation.
Yeah, yeah.
So that in itself suggests, or very big to point about the conviction of the soul back to the soul.
Yeah, right. I mean, if you and I, when we're dying, do you think we were on the now what's the point of sitting upright? You probably couldn't even sit up, right? You're probably in the ICU with all sorts of tubes Then? Yeah, it's hard to know. But then when the purpose is to sit upright, I wouldn't bother to sit up. Because the difference, isn't it? Then I sit up, then what happens if I don't die? How long should I sit there waiting to die, isn't it? So like if I put myself in a shoe, I can compare and say that, well, for me, I don't have that conviction. I also don't have the kind of practice, you know, the kind of practice that I can go back and rely on and say that, oh, this is what I'm going to do when I die, right? I don't have it. I know I don't have it. So the fact that if you observe someone's behavior, you see that they do certain things. And that behavior gives you a little bit of indication of what they know, or at least what they are convinced within themselves, right? And especially at the time of dying. It's not the time of pretending, right? It's the time where, you know, you go back and you rely on what is most essential for you. So that's why for me, he's special, and, you know, because I feel that this is just my own personal view. There are certain qualities that I see in his behavior. But I cannot tell what is on his mind, what is in his mind, yeah. Also the way he relates to his illness. No, so I also see that, well, no, if I'm in his shoes, I may not be as calm or as composed, or I might behave very differently. You never know how you behave, right? I used to joke with my teaching colleague that here we are, you know, teaching people about karma, about death, about rebirth, as if we really know, you know, everything. I don't know, maybe when I'm on the deathbed, don't come and visit me. Because I might, no, I might embarrass myself. I would be screaming. I don't want to die. No, yeah. So you never know, until you're confronted with reality. Then you realize how much of it is real practice, things that I have really internalized, and others are just intellectual knowledge that is blah 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 and blah blah blah, just repeat to other people. Yeah. So I think it's very important while we have the chance and when we are in relative good health and we have the opportunity to really familiarize and internalize things that we believe in, that we think can be helpful to us. Because, as you said, things can go back very quickly. Misfortune can come to us very suddenly. And then when we, at that time, we suddenly realize, I have not been well prepared. I have not, I look inside myself and I can't find anything to support myself at that moment. And that would be a real pity. So let's look at karma. In what way is it a protection? In what way is a protection? And usually when we come to this topic of karma or action, we present it in terms of four general characteristics. This is quite a common presentation within Tibetan Buddhism to talk about four general characteristics related to our actions and their consequences. Yeah. So I will just go through them. And then later I will explain how we can look at this whole topic of karma action and how is that related to the whole topic of protection. How does it protect us from suffering and help us to find happiness? Yeah, that's the whole idea. So the four general characteristics, some of you would have heard of it before. First one is about the appropriateness, about the definite relationship between actions and their consequences. This is a very famous one. That virtuous or wholesome actions bring happiness, and non-virtuous or unwholesome actions bring suffering. In fact, this is the first verse of the Dhammapada. Okay, so the Dhammapada, this collection of verses of Buddhist teaching, and the first two verses, this particular translation, it reads, all experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind, speak or act with a corrupted mind, and suffering follows as the wagon wheel follows the hoof of the ox. All experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind, speak or act with a peaceful mind, and happiness follows like a never departing shadow. So this is what we talk about, the first general characteristic. You start with a mind that is filled with the corrupted mind, or mind that is influenced by unwholesome or non-virtuous attitudes like hatred or greed or delusion, then if you act out of it, yeah, then as a result, as a consequence of that action, then it will be suffering, will be what suffering is, what will come as a consequence. No. And whereas if you act from a peaceful mind or wholesome mind, a mind like filled with kindness or compassion or wisdom, then happiness is what will follow. So that this is a very common there, you know, how you sow is how you reap, right? Or harvest. You know, so good action bring forth results that is happiness, and negative action, harmful action bring forth the result that is suffering. Okay. So there's this so-called definite relationship. I just briefly go through the four. I just list them and then we go back and look at them. The second general characteristic is that small actions can have huge results. Small actions can have huge results. So it doesn't mean that if the action seems trivial or small, the result must be equally trivial and small. So if just because you kill a mosquito, you mustn't think that the result will be trivial. Okay. And the third one is we do not experience the result if we have not created the cause. Okay. And the fourth one is actions we have created will not go to waste. It's not like some action we do and then there will be some result, and some action we do, there is no result. It just automatically disappears, which is really what we want. We should say, how can I cancel the action? I just murdered somebody. How can I cancel the karma? I don't have to experience the result of that action. How can I cancel it? So here it says that there's no such thing as canceling. So, so sometimes we may not see the result immediately, but it doesn't mean that there is no result. So actions created will not go to waste. So now I want to look a little bit deeper into each of these points and explain a little bit about it. But bear in mind, this is my understanding, my interpretation. I interpret it in a certain way. And if you heard it from or you read it from other sources, you may find that it's different. So what I actually want to encourage you is not so much to just believe what I say, but that, you know, these different things that you heard today, next week, I hope it's stimulating you to think a little bit about your action. Think about this relationship between action and their consequences. Right? It's not such a simple, it's not that simple, like, you know, I do this, then I get that, I do this, I get that. It's not really like that. There's more, things are more complicated than that. But the most important thing is to appreciate that our actions actually are powerful. Our actions have consequences. And so often, one of the very bad things is to think that our actions have absolutely no consequence at all. You know, we think that what we choose to do or not do have no impact at all on ourselves or on others. Now that would be very sad. Because in a way, we have given up doing anything at all, because what's the point of doing, you know, nothing is going to change, nothing is going to happen, and that, you know, that's it, just wait to die, don't wait around to die. Okay. So when you give up on that, you also give up on the very precious thing. That any moment, any choices we make, any action we make, they actually, they can have some real impact on ourselves or on others. They have consequences. And this is true right up to the point of death itself. Which is why, you know, I think Buddhists tend to get very busy around dying and death. Certainly there are many things to do, many prayers to recite, many things to paste on your body or sprinkle here and sprinkle there. And, you know, suddenly it becomes very busy. Yeah. When you're alive, you're not so busy. But when you're dying or when you're dead, you know, there are a lot of things that must happen to you. So, actions have consequences. So let's look a little bit at this whole idea that when we do something virtuous, or wholesome, with a virtuous or wholesome motivation, then happiness follows. And if we indulge in something, an unwholesome or harmful attitude, then suffering follows. Yeah. that is quite, we see this been expressed quite commonly, you know. But then again, we also see a lot of examples in life, you know, like my disclaimer, that we say, well, that person so awful, how come still live quite happily? They didn't suffer, they didn't die young, they didn't have some tragic accident happen to them. They just carry on living. Here I am, such a good person. Why am I suffering so much? So miserable, jobless, I don't know, what's wrong with this karma thing? So we, that's how we don't laugh. That's not uncommon. Uncommon interpretation of karma is like this, right? Most people think they're a good person. Let's face it. Let's who think that I'm a bad person. Most people think that I'm a decent person. I'm a good one. Trust me. Don't look too closely at what I've done, but I'm a good person. So I think, long time ago when I started studying Buddhism, that this whole promise of happiness behind Buddhism, this whole thing about, oh, you do this, you'll get happiness. That happiness is a special kind of happiness. So that's why I say that, because they all, if I study the Dharma, I practice Dharma, I will be happy. Thinking that that happiness is, if you rely on Buddhism, you will get what you want, or what you need in order to be happy. Actually, it's not true. Yeah, it's a marketing trick. You know how they will manage to fulfill it? They change your definition of happiness. You say, oh, I need $10 million in order to be happy. I'm, you know, working on my retirement fund. $10 million, let's say. What happened with Buddhism is you will be happy even if you only get one. Actually, I don't think I get it. You'll be happy with whatever you get. Okay. You understand what I'm trying to say? Otherwise, it's not contentment, right? People say, oh, I will only be contented when I hit my target, you know, $10 million. But that's not contentment, isn't it? Because chances are when you hit the $10 million, you say, maybe I try a little bit more, right? Go for $20 million. Contentment is like, you're happy with what you already have in this very moment. And so I think the secret of happiness in Buddhism is not so much about getting what we want, but actually in this very moment, be happy with what we have, or is already here. So that's a very big change in the definition of happiness, isn't it? So if you blah, you thought that, I join membership, I do this, I do that, then I'll get what I want. Well, sometimes you do, and I wouldn't say that you wouldn't get anything at all. But I think really the main type of happiness we talk about in Buddhism is really learning to be happy with whatever that is already here. So sometimes the expression is, instead of getting what you want what you get, what you have already bought. So if you think in that way, so this whole idea of how virtuous actions bring happiness and non-virtuous actions bring suffering, that happiness is not the happiness that we normally talk about getting what we want. That happiness is the happiness we find, we talk about in Buddhism, Nirvana. The happiness whereby you find contentment, you find peace, regardless of the external circumstances. And that is well supported by acting on the basis of wholesome attitudes like kindness, like compassion, like generosity, like patience, like discipline. You think if you have this policy, you will find that you will be happy regardless of whether you get what you want. And in fact, this quality can support you even when you encounter great difficulty, serious illness, or even when you face death. They'll be here to support you and help you to find kind of peace of mind. That's actually very, I think it's very precious, very important from the Buddhist perspective. So that is how I think the relationship works. That wholesome state of mind, acting our wholesome state of mind, brings peace and happiness of the Buddhist variety. Conversely, stepping out of non-virtuous things, unwholesome things like greed, hatred, delusion, jealousy. This unwholesome state of mind are said to be something called disturbing attitudes. They disturb the mind. And just by acting on them, just by dwelling on this state of mind, already your happiness disappears. Your mind is no longer peaceful, you're already unhappy. So that's how it brings suffering. You don't even have to wait for your actual action to ripen. Just by having this state of mind, you are already unhappy. I mean, you are upset, you are jealous, you are overwhelmed with craving and greed. Will you say you're happy? No, right. No. This state of mind already disturbs you. Okay? And the more you act out of it, the more you reinforce it, the more you strengthen them. So the more unhappy you are. And in that way, you increase your own suffering. Okay? So that's how I interpret this first one, the definite relationship between our actions and their consequences. Okay? Virtues bring happiness, non-virtues bring unhappiness, suffering. Okay? The second one, small actions can have huge results. An image that I really always come back to is this image of you have a pot, and let's say you are only allowed to fill it up with water with a dropper. But if you persist, you will eventually fill up this pot, even if you are using a dropper. In fact, this is a famous saying of how you just allow the water to drip. It can actually penetrate rock, right? The dripping water. If given enough time, it's able to penetrate rock. So never underestimate tiny little actions, especially in this case, cumulatively small actions. Hence, you must watch your diet. You know, just because they all eat out one day, okay lah. Eat out 2 days, 3 days, 4 days, and soon you will find that, you know, the diet that you have been regularly, you know, eating or taking actually has a very real impact on your health, right? Okay, so small actions can give and bring forth huge results. So this is the second one. Usually we mention this so that we do not underestimate little actions. Little actions like the way we treat people in our day-to-day life, you know, very little commonplace actions that we probably don't pay much attention to, you know, over a period of time can bring forth a huge result. Okay? A fact of, like, for example, quite often in relationship, not paying enough attention to the other person day in, day out, they're just too busy, Over a period of time, that act of not paying attention, not giving attention to the other to this, can have very real impact on your relationship with that person. So this is not uncommon in our modern, very busy lifestyle, that it's easy for us to take those people around us for granted, that we don't always have time to listen to them or to give them attention. So that is the second one. The third one, we do not experience the effect of the results without creating the cause. The cause is this action. We don't act in a certain way, we won't get the result or the consequence of that action. Which makes sense, isn't it? You know? So quite often when I find myself complaining, you know, typical Singapore, grumble, complain. I used to complain while I make water bowls often. It's a wonderful time to complain about life. You know, like let's say this is a lot. I used to limit it to 21 bowls. This is too much work. So then I just, you know, fill up, number, you know, why am I doing this? Why am I the only one doing this? Why nobody clear this and do this? You know, just grumble through the whole thing, you know. Because you're so familiar with the activity, right? You just grumble. I also mentioned this is old story. Usually by the time I reach the last bowl, then I suddenly realize, oh no, this is supposed to be an offering to the world. What did I do? I don't have a virtuous mind, and all I did was fill water with a grumbling mind. You know, so there's no virtue at all. The first 20 bowls, absolutely zero virtue. I'm just pouring water into bowls. That's all. So the last one, I'll be very mindful. Yes, this is for you, Buddha. Om Mahom, Om Mahom, Om Mahom. So I only got the merit of one bowl. Okay. And complaining is a little bit like saying, you know, and why am I not getting the result I deserve? You know, I want this, I want that. Why are they not happening? Okay. And one of the main reasons, of course, is I'm not actually doing the thing to bring those results into reality. You know. That's why we complain. You know. Because actually doing is so difficult, so leche, so hard, so hard work, so inconvenient. So complain is easier. You know. I just use my mouth and blah, 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 blah. No need to put in the real hard work, isn't it? Of course, the end result is I don't get to enjoy the result, the consequence of it, because I didn't actually create the cause. Right? So again, a very simple idea, but sometimes you think about it, it makes perfect sense. And I can see in my own behavior, I don't know what sort of karma is. That karma which is created. My karma. I find that quite often I might be unhappy or upset, and I find myself wrong with it, either to myself or if there's an audience, to the audience. Right? But if I stop and think about it, that grumbling or that complaining is not going to bring the actual result into fruition. Instead, I need to think, oh, what about action? What can I actually do to make it happen to you? So I find that I fall into this trap. I want the consequences, I want to enjoy the result, but I don't want to put in the effort or make the sacrifice to create the cause, to act in a certain way to bring that result into me. This is the third point to remember. Sometimes if we want certain results or certain effects, we actually need to take the appropriate action. The fourth one about how our actions can be created are not supposed to wait. Now this is it's important to understand that often people think that karma is fixed. There's nothing you can do to change it. Something happens, that's it. There's nothing you can do about it. Actually, the whole teaching, the Buddhist teaching of karma, is really not about fate. It's not about fate. It's to tell you, at any moment, right here, right now, you can always do something about it. It doesn't mean that you can change everything. You always can do something about it. You can do something about it now. So that you change, maybe you can change your experience now, or you at least you can definitely change the future. It's actually a very positive idea, this teaching of karma. And I like to think that it's a forward-looking teaching. You know? If you don't like where you are now, do something about it. You can create a causes, you can act to bring a different future into effect. Right? So often people interpret karma in a backward looking, you know, they look, what have I done in the past to deserve this? Anyway, it's already done, right? And chances are, it already happened. You have experienced the effect. Of course, if you learn something from it, that's wonderful. But most of the time, it's done deal. Okay? If I broke my leg, the leg is already broken. Right? Even though I don't like it, I might complain. I say, I didn't deserve it. Sorry, it's already broken. Right, let's move on. But what I do from this point onwards can make a difference. Right?
Can I do something? Sorry, I just do something about the pain in and pain out.
It's either no sound or this too.
It's alright. Don't worry.
But what actions I take from this moment on can make a difference. Right? You know, how well the wound will heal, whether they will be able to regain mobility, the function, and so on and so forth. Yeah. So I like to think of karma as a forward-looking teaching, you know, that at any moment, we can always make a choice. There's always a choice. We are always choose to act, you know, in a different way. And by making different choices, by acting differently, we can create a different future. Okay. So it's a very encouraging, very empowering teaching of karma. Make sense? Mm-hmm. So this whole thing about actions we have done will not go to waste is that just because I do something and I don't see the effect immediately, I mustn't think that well, there is no effect at all. And sometimes how our actions bring about results is a very complicated process. It doesn't only just depend on me, it depends on a lot of conditions. Right? But when the conditions are right, then certain results will come in its own time. Okay? So it's to tell us that just because we do not see the result immediately, it doesn't mean that there is no result, no effect. That, oh, what's the point of meditating? Nothing happened. I still didn't get what I want. No. So as if the meditation, especially those bad sessions of meditation, are of no consequence or no effect. That's not true. In fact, I usually tell people, it is the accumulation of many bad sessions of meditation. Then suddenly you have this fantastic session. Oh, I must be half enlightened. No, my mind has no thought at all. It's so peaceful and so blissful. And the whole hour passed, like 5 minutes like that. Wow, I must have arrived. And then, of course, the next session, you went back, you know. The whole hour you are either daydreaming or thinking about this, thinking about that, or you fall asleep. You know, it's like the worst session you ever had. Yeah. Actually, this so-called good and bad session is not what you think it is. In fact, a lot of times during the so-called bad session is where we put in the hard work, we work with the habits of the mind, and then after we work with it for a while, then we have this so-called good session. That's when the conditions you have created come together. And then you'll find that actually you can experience the peace of mind in your meditation. Okay? So this is just a very brief presentation of the four general characteristics, that there is a definite relationship between our actions and their consequences. And usually we say virtuous actions conducive for happiness and non-virtuous ones bring suffering. That not to underestimate your small actions. And small actions if committed regularly over a period of time can have huge results, and that if we want certain results, we need to act accordingly. Because, how do you say, without creating the cause, we will not enjoy the effect. This is the third point. The fourth point is, actions we created, they don't just suddenly go to waste. Sometimes, in fact, we need a period of time for things to, for the effect to be apparent, and also for other cases to require the right conditions to come together for us to see the effect. Okay, up to this is four general characteristics. It's a good way to introduce the Buddhist topic of karma, of action, just to give you some idea about it. Up to this point, is there any questions? Don't ask me, last week or last month or last year, something happened to me. What is the cause of it in your past life? I have absolutely no idea. Okay? Yeah? How do I reconcile that bad things can happen to good people and good things can happen to bad people? Bad things that happen to good people, how do I reconcile it? I reconcile it by saying that the whole topic of karma, of action, is not about absolute control. Yeah. A lot of times people use this topic of karma in this particular way. They say, oh, my business is failing. Oh. Then someone will say, go and, they're on this. Or someone is dying. Quick animal liberation. go and liberate animal. If you liberate enough animal, you don't have to die. Because you stay alive, right? That is the result, you don't have to die, right? Or then they say, like you business losing money. Oh, practice generosity. If you are generous enough, then as a result, your business will revive and then wealth will come to you. So then deliver. That is very specific. Do this thing for 7 days or do that for X number of numbers and do this and that. Then we feel that, oh, we're very excited, right? Now we can do something. And we feel that if we do it, then we'll get what we want. Or we'll get rid of what we don't want. And then life is back in our control. Yeah. And it's within this broad framework, then we find it difficult to say, but I do all these good things. How come bad things happen to me? Right? Or that person, such an awful person, how come all these good things happen to them? That's how you read, we interpret the whole presentation of karma. But actually, I think karma is not really about control. Karma is to understand that everything depends on multiple conditions. We live, we are born, we live certain lives, we have certain experiences, and then we die. Every one of those experiences depend on multiple conditions. Okay? Some of those conditions are of our own making. Some of those conditions are the actions of people around us. Some of it are from the past. Some of it are from the environment. So it's a combination of all these many, many different factors, conditions. At any moment, we experience a certain, we have a certain experience, certain effect. Right? And so the topic of karma is to ask us to become more sensitive to this, the conditional nature of reality, and that we can influence how things happen. We cannot control, we cannot dictate, but we can influence. So if we want things to go this direction, we can try to, push it towards this direction. We want to go that direction, we try to push it towards that direction. But whether it will happen the way we want it depends also on other conditions. Right? So I can give it a push. If I don't push, maybe it doesn't happen. But if I give you a push, it may or may not happen. But it also depends on other conditions. So in other words, we can create the cause, but we cannot determine the outcome. We cannot absolutely determine the outcome. Right? But it doesn't mean that we are helpless or hopeless, right? We just can't do anything. No, we can create new conditions. We can try to influence the flow of outcome of our lives, of our experiences. And that is, so this is actually part of the teaching of conditionality on dependence arising. The Buddhist teaching of dependence arising is that if you, the more wisdom you have, the more in tune you are with the different conditions, the better you are at picking the right time, doing the right thing. Like, Zhuge Liang, this famous, in English, Jie Dong Feng, you remember? That because he knew how the weather pattern is, he used it to his advantage in the war, right? So the wisdom in this case is understanding conditions. And then understanding at the right time, the right place to do the right thing. And then you can, create a certain outcome, certain desirable, result. Okay. But that is dependent on other conditions and dependent on your wisdom. So I think that is actually the teaching of karma. And so we find it strange that, The reason why we have that disclaimer is because we have a different understanding of karma. We think that, oh, if I do good, I can control my life. I can get rid of all the things that I don't want. I can hold on to the things that I want. But unfortunately, if you think like this, you're bound to be disappointed. Because the Buddhist teaching, the first noble truth of suffering, there's birth, and therefore there will be aging, there will be sickness, there will be death. There will be meeting with the unpleasant, there will be separation from the pleasant, and there will be some wishes of us it will not be fulfilled. Okay? Now, I don't think that just by becoming more realized, enlightened, you will get rid of these seven things. You don't get rid of them. But what happens is, you don't suffer over them. Okay? You don't suffer over aging anymore. You don't suffer over illness. You also don't suffer over the fact that you have died. You don't suffer when you encounter things that you don't like or unpleasant. And you will also not be surprised to be separated from the pleasant. And then you will be able to face with equanimity if some of your wishes are not fulfilled. And it is actually precisely this quality, this wisdom and equanimity that we see in realized master, that we really appreciate. That it's not that their life is perfect, you know, they don't have any problems, and they, you know, they will never get drenched on by the rain, and they never miss their flight. Nothing unpleasant happened to them. In fact, a lot of these great realized masters encounter huge suffering, you know, terrible, terrible circumstances. Look at the Dalai Lama. You know, could you imagine? You're still a teenager. You lost the entire country. You have to go into exile, and then you have to figure out what to do with your own people as a teenager. You then like try to negotiate, you know, and try to stand up for your own people against very powerful other people, powerful countries. You know, there's a lot of suffering, a lot of disappointment, a lot of setback. And yet we admire him because he is able to face all these difficulties, you know, and yet still be able to maintain a very happy, always very joyful, very positive, optimistic. That shows great strength, inner strength. Right? So then you will say, well, if it's a Dalai Lama, you should not have any suffering at all. You should always get what you want and never get what you don't want. But that is clearly not true, isn't it? Right? So that's why I think quite often we misunderstand what karma is all about. Which is understandable. You know, but deep down, what we really, really want is to get what we want, right? And to not have what we don't want, isn't it? It's a very understandable, very human, in fact, the dilemma is that it's actually our instinct, our desire to be happy, to have what we want, our desire not to suffer, to not experience the unwanted. Okay? But the way to actualize it is not about trying to achieve absolute control, but it's really understanding how to work with different conditions and how powerful our actions can be. Actions can be part of that condition. We can create favorable conditions for our own happiness. I hope that makes some sense. Yes. Okay, so you're saying, you know, previously I talked about there's happiness that we long for, and there may be happiness that what we can get through the Dharma. Yeah, and whether this happiness that we long for is what we call suffering or change in the teaching, sometimes there's this term suffering or change. So in the teaching there are three types of suffering. Suffering or suffering, which is the most obvious, the painful thing, that pleasant thing. Suffering or change is that all those pleasant experiences that we have, unfortunately, they don't stay around. You know? They change and then they disappear. You know? Because then the last one is for all pervasive suffering. So, yes, you can say that suffering of change is, you know, part of, it's another way of talking about, actually I prefer the term conditional happiness. So what we look for are conditional happiness. This means happiness that depends on certain conditions. Happiness that depends on being healthy, happiness that depends on being wealthy, happiness that depends on having the right partner, the right children, the right house, the right car, the right amount of money in the bank. You know? So they are conditional. They depend on conditions. And of course there are many times when the conditions are there, hey, we are happy about it. You know? How wonderful it is. But the problem with conditions is that they change. So when the conditions change, then the happiness that's built on them also change, also disappear. And there's nothing wrong about it. That's the reality. And so we suffer when we don't see clearly. So that's why it becomes suffering. Because it's not that it shouldn't change, but it's we expect it not to change, and yet it changed. And therefore we are disappointed. Therefore we are, you know, we found that, oh, I must have done something wrong. Actually, we haven't done anything wrong. But it is their nature for them to change. Having said that, which also means that if you have the right attitude, then all those things are not a problem. The right partner, the right relationship, the right house, the right amount of money, all those are not a problem. You don't have to get rid of them. You see? You know what I mean? Because they are what they are. You know? They are just conditions. And when the conditions are there, then you get to enjoy it, you get to experience it. You know? And if you have the right attitude towards them, and when they change, you don't have to suffer. So often people think that this whole idea of renunciation. So renunciation means you cannot have too much material comfort. You must really make yourself. You must suffer a bit. You cannot be too comfortable. Otherwise you cannot be realized. No, you must go to a cave. No, you must go to a cave. Only in a cave can you be enlightened. Cave is very uncomfortable. You know what they do? They renovate their cave. No? They put a wall there. No, then they put the bed in, no, they whitewash the wall, you know, they just basically decorate the cave. And then they will take enlightenment in comfort. Right? We used to joke about this, this whole idea of austerity, yeah. And we say, this, at one point, we're all trying to find a place to do long retreat. And this part of the requirement of my 7-year master program. For this world. At the end of it, we all have to do a long retreat. I managed only 4 months. I have friends who did 1 year, solitary, long retreat. We used to joke about what we really need in order to have a good retreat, a good meditation retreat today. Proper toilet facilities. Very important. Yeah, I suffer over the 4 months. I have a type of, it's not really a compost toilet, actually. It's a bizarre. This is a toilet that's not attached to a sewage system. Try not to use it next time, okay? There's some disastrous story to come out of it. Yeah. Then we among friends, we used to joke about what is the basic minimum requirement that we can live with in order to do a long retreat, right? Of course, we're not like aiming for a Shangri-La hotel room kind of. We are more modern and more renowned than that. But we have a baseline. No. You are then think your privacy is very important. Then no neighbors around. No, far, far away. Don't want to see them. They're always very troublesome, feeling the people. And then toilet, shower. Bath would be good, but maybe asking a bit too much, yeah. In Singaporean usually don't have a bathtub, but no. A shower, proper shower. Running water, very important. Can you imagine carrying water? It's really hard work here. Because we also heard of other horror story of other retreatants doing retreat. There's one very famous couple of very devoted students of Lamadu Rinpoche who did a long retreat, I think 3-year retreat in Vermont in the US. It's apparently very, very, very cold in winter. It's like, I think even water bowl can freeze and become ice. And they don't have running water, they don't have proper heating system. We said, my God, that is a retreat from hell. We always said, oh no, we are not doing that kind of retreat. We want to do a little bit more high class kind of retreat, yeah. Conditional happiness. Just to answer your question. Sorry. I get distracted. But the kind of happiness that Buddhism talk about is unconditional happiness. How can you still be happy and at peace? But even when conditions change, so that's why sometimes we call it nirvana. Yeah. Nirvana is usually people understand something that's unconditional. And so that's the difference between the type of happiness that, in the Dharma is aiming for. So, I think personally, we really ought to in our best capacity aim for an unconditional happiness. Isn't it wonderful? That means we can be happy regardless of changing conditions. Right? And of course we try to control or influence, but there will be many occasions where we cannot control, right? And yet we can still be happy, we can still be at peace and at ease. That would be wonderful, isn't it? Who wouldn't want that? But having said that, you mustn't give up on conditional happiness. Also very important. Like for example, when you meditate, make sure you find a bliss-producing cushion. So I used to travel with my bliss-producing cushion. It's a cushion that I've taken many years to find. It will fit my butt atop the bed. And then every time I just put myself on it, and then I know, you know, I don't need to adapt to the cushion. The cushion adapts to me. And I can have, at least posture-wise, it'll be no problem. Conditional happiness. Right? Don't give up on it too easily, okay? Just don't expect too much from it either. But unfortunately, when I moved to Australia, because of Australian custom, this very, very strict custom, and the content of my bliss-producing cushion is, I think it's buckwheat husk, so it's plant material. So I managed to smuggle it in, but then after that, I dare not smuggle it out. Because if ever one occasion, they open it and say, what's inside this? I would have to open up my cushion and empty the entire content into the bin, and there go my bliss. Yeah. Because afterwards, it will be very hard to find just the right amount of husk to get it back to that, you know, that condition that will produce bliss. This bliss is very conditional. So, anyway, so that is basically what I want to present today. We're going to do a meditation, and this meditation is for you to explore a little bit on the relationship between action and happiness, how to help you find happiness or help to protect you from suffering. It's actually a meditation on equanimity. Equanimity is a state of mind whereby the mind is protected from extreme reactions. So you won't get very, very attached. You also won't get very, very angry in the face of changing conditions of happiness. So it's like, I used to call it, because I'm a chemist, it's like a buffer. A buffer is something, a buffer solution, actually from a chemical point of view, but the capacity to modulate change. You encounter something drastic from an atom active alkaline, you can modulate the pH so that it doesn't change too much. So in a way, you can modulate your reaction. Just because situation in your life change, you don't have this kind of like, I call it yo-yo state, right? You go very high up, or you go, you punch down. You have some reactions, not flat lines, not like, don't feel anything. You have some reaction, but your reaction is modulated, and you can, on the basis of it, respond to what is happening. Okay? But you wouldn't experience this kind of like, heaven and hell, which after a while is very, very tiring. You happen to go through a period of life where there's a lot of upheaval. You find that you have been sort of tossed up and down by changing circumstances. In those situations, you really long for a day where it's just a boring day. Nothing happens. You just wake up and you just do your regular things, and at the end of the day, you just go to sleep. Nothing happens. And for you, it's a blessing. Just compared to what happened previously, all this up and down, down and up, you really will long for something almost neutral. Okay, so equanimity is a state of mind that allows you to modulate so that you can face whatever changes, and yet you will be able to respond to it. How to cultivate equanimity? Again, I use a few phrases. So I just, and what you do is you just repeat the phrases in your mind. And see how that phrase applies to you, applies to your experiences, applies to your relationship with other people. Okay? So the phrases go, we are the owners of our actions. So first of all, myself. So we are the owners of our actions. My happiness and unhappiness depend on my actions. not merely on my vision for myself. Okay? So I repeat again. We are the owners of our actions. My happiness and unhappiness depend on my actions, not merely on my vision for myself. Okay? So you can do a lot of things. You repeat the phrase and you try to reflect a bit and on how it applies to you, whether you agree with the wording or not. And sometimes as you repeat the phrase, it can stir something things up for you. And then you can look at it. You can also apply this phrase in your relationship with another person, which sometimes can be interesting. So then you change the phrase and say, we are the owners of our actions. Your happiness and unhappiness depend on your actions, not merely on my wishes for you. Okay? This is very good for people who have a hard time drawing boundaries in their relationship. They say, oh, I cannot say like this. I cannot say that. That sounds so harsh, so cold. What about your happiness and unhappiness depend on your actions? Surely I can do something for them. Actually, it doesn't mean you cannot do anything for them. But you must also draw a line and understand that. But they are also doing something right. And their actions impact on their happiness and their unhappiness as well. Basically, you cannot live your life for them. Right? So, we are the owners of action. Your happiness and unhappiness depend on your actions, not merely on my wishes for you. Okay? So, these are the two sets of phrases that will be used in this community meditation. Okay, so, let's give it a try. So, I'll guide you through this. And just find your bliss producing posture, not a pain producing posture. Choose a posture that doesn't cause you unnecessary pain and discomfort. So if you're sitting on the floor, you can try to have your leg crossed in whichever way is more comfortable and supportive. And those of us sitting on chairs, try to have both feet firmly planted on the ground to provide a good sense of support for your body. The most important thing is actually with the back and spine. Try to make sure that it is upright in a natural way. Such a way that you don't have to consciously tense up your back muscles to keep it upright. Just allow the spine to assume its natural position, its natural position. Rest your hands on your knees or place them one on top of the other. Rest them on your lap. In such a way that your both shoulders can be relaxed. Usually I recommend people to just close their eyes completely, although you are most welcome to leave them open or half open. And just direct your gaze towards the ground in front of you. So give your body a few moments to settle into this posture. Become aware of sensation beneath you at the point of contact between your body and the cushion, the chair, your body and the ground. You feel that your body is resting on something very firm, solid, stable. And then your body is well supported in this posture, feels balanced and safe. And you can allow your body spontaneously in its own time to start to loosen up, to unwind, to release some of those unnecessary tension or tightness. So that's the first step, acquiring a deep and supportive seat for your body. And then the second step is going to take some time, a few minutes, to help our body and mind to settle into meditation, to transition, to set aside things that are occupying the mind. So to do that, we can make use of our breath. See if you can become aware of the sensation of your breath in your body. See if you can experience your in-breath, your out-breath. So notice sensation from the ground, maybe around your nostrils, maybe in your chest. Maybe even at your abdomen. As much as possible, see if you can just allow the breath to flow naturally. You don't have to control the breath. You don't have to make it longer, or deeper, or slower. You just allow the body to breathe itself. And see if you can return your attention to the sensation of the breath. Allow yourself to experience that wave-like movement of the breath from in and out, ascending, contracting, rising, and falling. See if you can give special attention to your natural out-breath. Become aware as you breathe out and notice that there is a subtle sense of relaxation that comes along with it. As the muscles of your diaphragm, the muscles of your chest come to relax in order for you to breathe out. So coming back to the breath sensation again and again with patience, each time you breathe out, you can remind yourself of the release. Remind your body that it can release any necessary tightness or tension. Remind your mind that you can release or set aside all images at the top of your mind. See if you can return your attention to the breath sensation in your body. No need to be upset if you find that your mind gets distracted or that your mind may feel a bit drowsy or sleepy. As much as possible, just come back to the breath sensation. And as you breathe out, imagine you can deepen the sense of relief. And then we can allow this process of releasing the settling down of our body and mind into meditation. We just continue in the background. And for the third step, we're going to turn our attention to meditate on equanimity, to meditate on karma. And we do that by slowly and mindfully repeating the following verse. We are the owners of our actions. My happiness and unhappiness dependent on my actions, not just on my wishes or my thoughts. So you can do it in your own way, how you choose to meditate on this. What I usually do is repeat the verse, and then pause for a while to see whether it triggers any thought, any reaction. You may want to explore a little bit the meaning of the verse, whether you agree with it or disagree with it. We are the owner of our actions. My happiness and unhappiness depend on my actions, not merely on my wishes. Time and again, when in doubt, you can always come back to the verse and repeat it. You are the owners of my actions. My happiness and unhappiness depend on my actions, not merely on my wishes or myself. Just in your own way, explore a bit the meaning of the words you define. Think a little bit of the relationship between your actions and your happiness and unhappiness. Coming back to the world, especially if you realize that you're distracted, that is perfectly normal. Come back to the world. We are the owners of our actions. My happiness and unhappiness depend on my actions, not merely on my wishes or my doubts. You can even ask yourself, have you been creating the actions that are conducive to your happiness? Or are you engaging in action to actually bring about unhappiness in yourself? We are the owners of our actions. My happiness and unhappiness depend on my actions, not merely on my wishes or myself. then feel free to continue with this one. But if you want to try out in relation to someone else, the way you can do is to bring a person to mind, someone close to you, and then repeat the similar verse directed and that person. We are the owners of our actions. Your happiness and unhappiness depend on your actions, not merely on my wishes for you. And as you repeat the verse, you can reflect a little bit. See what comes up, does it fill up in you in relation to your relationship with someone else? We are the owners of our actions. Your happiness and unhappiness depend on your actions, not merely on my wishes for you. And once again, come back on your attention to the verse. We are the owner of our actions. Your happiness and unhappiness depend on your actions, not merely on our wishes for you. And let's go a little bit about the whole idea of responsibility, of what you can do or cannot do for another, and how powerful their actions can be in influencing their happiness. Then to conclude the meditation, we can do a simple dedication. We can dedicate by gathering up anything positive we create in our meditation and thinking about the Dharma or Karma. You gather that positive momentum and you give it a direction. You dedicate it towards the fulfillment of your aspirations for yourself, and it can also be aspirations for others. Especially if someone you know are in a difficult situation. can also dedicate this conscious energy towards their well-being, towards good rebirth, and so forth. So let's just keep quiet for a few more moments and do our own personal dedication. Okay, so there is a meditation on equanimity that touch on karma, the meditation on actions and consequences. And I think it's an interesting meditation. Each time I meditate on it, I get a different conclusion, different ideas come to mind. So any last questions? Today. Count the second. Yes, you mind that? This understanding of karma. Is it train your intention? Help us to focus on, help us to pay attention to our actions, actually. It's not all up in the head. It's really about, the more you understand about the power of karma, then you pay attention to your actions. You look at what have I been doing? I'm not doing. What are the choices I've been making? This action, some of the actions are actually choice, right? I choose to do this, I choose not to do this. Right? And you add up all those actions and choices, then you get a good sense that am I moving in the direction with the future that I want? Or am I sort of deviating from it? Like, I want this future, but I'm not creating the form for it. Motivate us to a positive intention. Of course, yeah, sure. No. I'd rather say that motivate us to create the appropriate action for the result that we want. No, the result that we seek. Right? So you decide for yourself if you want to suffer, but I mean, to create the unwholesome actions that you know. Yes, disturb as you want, and then you can experience the corresponding result. You know, or conversely, if you say, oh, I want to be happy, then it's good to ask yourself, what is that happiness? What does it entail? And then in order for me to achieve it, what are the conditions I need to create? And some of that conditions will be the actions that I take, the choices that I make. So you are saying, okay, so having set a positive motivation and engage in positive action, is it that we need to be non-grasping towards the outcome? Yes, that is true. Because part of the teaching of karma is to understand that outcome, final result, are dependent on many different conditions. Our actions are just part of that condition. So, in other words, we don't get to 100% determine the outcome. And then sometimes we may act with the best intention, we do the best we can with the most positive motivation, and then the outcome didn't turn out to be the one we want. and the results are not what we expected to be. Yeah. And that goes to show that the outcome or the result are dependent on more than just our actions. It depends on multiple conditions. And if the conditions are not right, then we will not get that particular result. We'll get some result, but not that particular result. So yes, therefore, you can say that to be non-attached towards the outcome. I missed the first sentence. What do you say? Actually, you don't need faith. You don't actually need to know anything at all about karma. It still happens, isn't it? You are believing it, I don't believe it, I agree. So on, the conditions come, results will happen. Whether I believe in it, in karma or not, doesn't really matter. This is a good thing about understanding about karma. Even if you are only half believing it, is to give you a handle on the happening of things. It gives you some kind of insight into the fact, into particularly the power and the limitation of our actions. It helps us to appreciate that, wow, actually, the kind of actions that I do physically, verbally, and even mentally actually can have quite huge consequences. So that I can make full use of it. Full use of what I do to create a favorable future. You don't actually have to believe in karma. No, because as with what it's like to say, whether you believe in it or not, it is still true, isn't it? No. But the fact that if you have some understanding of it, and ideally if you have great conviction in it, then it gives you great impetus to take care of your actions, to take care of what you do or don't do, so that you can have a greater influence over the outcome. People who are not convinced about the relationship between action and consequences will think differently. Right? They may think that, well, no, it all depends on chance. No need to work so hard. If the chance are there, then I'll get it. If the chance are not there, okay. Most people don't actually think like this. We actually, intuitively, we do know that our actions or our choices have consequences. Just look at the 4D, the one that sell 4D, right? Well, the queue is like so long, because everybody knows if I don't buy the number, I will have no chance of winning it. I buy, I may not win. But if I don't buy, for sure I will not win. Which is why the long queue is, that shows the power of our understanding of action, isn't it? So I think deep down within us, we do understand it in our own way. Very popular, no? I would say one of the among all those shops in the neighborhood, right? The one always a queue, no? The other shop, like, no customer, right? This one's like, endless customer, especially like if the Toto or whatever has accumulated a lot of them. I was always impressed at such a good business. Yeah. I work for not for profit, like, one of the major sponsors is Toadbot, right? One of the one, you know, they do that, deal with the gambling. Then surely profit margin must be huge, isn't it? Millions and millions of dollars given to you to do community projects, to help the seniors, or help the whatever. So that's how lucrative that business is. It goes to show how strong our imprint is that if I don't buy that number. It's a funny thing. I think, like, I've known maybe one of my family members buying the same number continuously for years, right? The number of the car that we burn for the deceased, whatever, you know, that phone number there, you know, they just persistently buying it, and then over the years, how many times you manage to strike, isn't it? Then the 1 week that you forgot to buy, first price, what the karma is this? Yeah, I'm just joking. But, okay, so next week we'll take another look at karma and how our understanding and practice of karma actually can be a protection for us and help us protect us from suffering and unhappiness and help us achieve happiness. So thank you very much for your attention. Have a good week.